Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome and thanks for joining us today. I recently spoke with Sarah Franklin about her new book, Biological Relatives, IVF, Stem Cells, and the Future of Kinship. This was produced by Duke University Press in 2013. Among the many reasons that I love this book was the way that it takes a broadly transdisciplinary approach to understanding a really fascinating case study in science studies, and that is IVF, in vitro fertilization, and related stem cell technologies. In the course of the book, what Franklin does is she treats simultaneously the kind of work that's done by scientists in laboratories, the kind of work that's done by philosophers, by historians, by anthropologists, the work that's done by artists, by patients, by clinical doctors, and the work not just of generating ideas and generating egg technologies, but also generating pipettes, generating all different sorts of tools and images as part of the story of, and is integral to understanding the story of IVF and why it matters. Over the course of the book, you see, and you'll hear about this in the conversation to come, that not only does it do the kind of work that changes the way we think about biology, but it also changes the way we think about what counts as a technology, as a tool. And it, at least for me, made me think of the relevance of the work of Marx, the work of Derrida, and also the work of a whole bunch of anthropologists as being really now central to how I think about tools and instruments and technologies in a really new way. So I really enjoyed the book, as I'm sure is clear just from these comments. It was really a pleasure to talk with Sarah Franklin about it, and I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. We're here today to talk with Sarah Franklin about her new book, Biological Relatives, IVF, Stem Cells, and the Future of Kinship. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Sarah, and thanks very, very much for negotiating the time difference and for making time to talk with me today.
Thanks, Carla. My pleasure.
So, Sarah, could you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and your background, and specifically, how did you come to this field that is broadly defined as science studies? What brought you here as an academic pursuit?
Well, I started out in women's studies and anthropology at Smith College, and I then did a MA in women's studies in the United Kingdom, and I then came back to the U.S. to begin to do work in anthropology on reproduction and reproduction-related issues. Although the topic I chose, which was to do an ethnography of IVF, was a little bit too sort of modern and technological. So I ended up doing a more interdisciplinary PhD in England at the Birmingham Center for Contemporary Cultural Studies, where I was part of one of the first groups to do a kind of cultural analysis of science within CCCS, which was an important school at Birmingham doing cultural studies. And so, you know, that was a time, the mid-1980s, of a lot of interesting changes in reproductive politics. And it was obviously a time of a lot of very interesting changes in terms of reproductive technology. And I've basically worked on that issue ever since. Actually, in some ways, Biological Relatives gave me the opportunity to look back on, 30 years of studying IVF.
Great. So the book, as you've mentioned, looks at IVF, or in vitro fertilization, for listeners who may not have heard that terminology, and the worlds that it creates and inhabits as a frame to look at the notion of biological relativity. And we'll talk about that a little bit in the course of the conversation, I'm sure, to look at the changing relationships and notions of biology and technology, and to look at notions of kinship, among many, many other things. So it's an extraordinarily rich study, and we'll only get to some, I'm sure, of the many, many kinds of work that the book does, but we'll definitely get to at least some of that. So you've already spoken a little bit about how you came to this topic, and in fact, it sounds like you began really in many ways looking at this topic. But how did you come to the point, when you did, of deciding to write a book-length monograph on this, and specifically writing a book-length monograph that is this object, that looks like this, that has this sort of a scope?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. And I did write my PhD on in vitro fertilization in part because I felt it was important to find out more about what women and couples who are using it expect from the technology and how they experience the technology. And what were their rationales really for using this new means of technologically assisted conception? And so I wrote my first book about IVF in the early 1990s. It was published in 1997, called Embodied Progress, A Cultural Account of Assisted Conception. And at that time, I think it was a little unclear what was going to happen to IVF. Its success rates weren't really that great. It was reasonably controversial. It was still really an exceptional way to go about having children. And one of the really surprising things about IVF from the late 1980s, early 1990s onwards is how incredibly quickly it became very popular, and how rapidly it expanded, both geographically and also technologically, how many other applications came to be based on IVF. And then, you know, with the development of somatic cell nuclear transfer and cloning and stem cells and all of the kind of brave new biology projects of the early 21st century, it became clear that the story of IVF was in some ways very paradoxical, because on the one hand, it had been naturalized so quickly, normalized so quickly, and popularized so quickly. But on the other hand, it had changed so much, and it had in many ways become more radical while it was becoming more normal.
Great. Now, as we get into the book, you're going to proceed in a series of chapters, or you do proceed in the book in a series of chapters to explore different aspects of this phenomenon and to explore it in different ways. And so some of the chapters engage a more kind of historical archival approach with archive defined and determined broadly. Some of them are based on a kind of deep ethnographic approach within an IVF lab or a stem cell research lab. And some of them explore the work of take a broadly historiographical approach and or go into in great detail or in great depth, rather, some of the notions, the philosophical notions and the philosophers and conceptual theorists who ground and who have undergirded the kinds of concepts that are or that inhabit the book and that enliven the book. But to begin with, in the introduction, you set out a kind of framing that recurs throughout many of the chapters. And this is a framing that's offered in terms of the rubric of curiosity, right? Curiouser and curiouser. You talk about IVF early in the book as, I think as you put it, a looking glass through which we see ourselves. And this trope of the looking glass, specifically in the context of Alice, Alice, who some listeners might know from Wonderland, others might know from Through the Looking Glass, Alice appears here as a kind of touchstone for thinking about IVF in terms of what you call curiouser and curiouser, right? So can you maybe start us off as we now get into the book by talking about this framing, the framing of IVF in terms of a looking glass and in terms of something that is, as you put it, curiouser and curiouser? How are you thinking about this in terms of the larger goals and arguments of the book?
Well, I think a lot of people in science and technology studies will be familiar with the work of Raymond Williams, and in particular his claim in his famous book on television that the question of technology is one of the least well understood topics in all of social science. And there's a reason for this, he says. He says the reason that technology is so poorly understood is because we already think we know what its impact has been. So when it comes to something like television, we already assume that it's had an impact and that we can understand the impact and study the impact and so forth. But this leads us in a bit of a loop, because even the impact model itself, you know, an analogy drawn from physics to describe a collision, doesn't really necessarily reveal very much about the complexity of social interactions that we might describe as technological change. So I'm really interested in this book and using IVF as a way to defamiliarize how we think about technology. And I am approaching IVF as something that we think we know what it is. We think it's obvious what it is. It's a way for people who can't have children to get technological assistance in order to have them. But I argue in the book that the more carefully we look at IVF, the more carefully we look at its history, the more carefully we looked at the ethnography on it, the more carefully we listen to people who are talking about it, whether they're professionals who work with it or people who are undergoing it, the stranger it is. So that during the very same period that IVF has become more natural, more normal, or as Stuart Brand says, more regular, or even a model of how technology becomes naturalized, during that very same period from the 1980s until now, I argue IVF has in many ways also become stranger and stranger, or even queerer and queerer. As we go forward, what we see is a technology that has dramatically reshaped how we understand fertility, how we understand kinship, how we understand gender, how we understand reproduction. So this technology, which is frequently represented as something that's just like what would have happened anyway, or just like a biological process, on closer examination turns out to be a technology that's actually changed what the biological means.
Great. And one of the things that it helps us reframe and that it has changed, as you argue in the book, is also the notion of relativity. The book title engages the notion of biological relativity. The introduction is called Relatively Biological. And throughout the book, you're using IVF to explore what you call the emergence of biological relativity. So since it does occupy such a prominent place early in the book, and it's such an important concept for us to understand as we proceed to get into the nuts and bolts, more of the texture of the book in the later chapters, can you start us off here in terms of our further exploration by talking a little bit about this concept, the concept of biological relativity? What does this mean for you, and what's important for us to understand about this notion in order for us to understand the kind of work that you're going to use it to do later on in the book?
Yeah, well, this is very much a book about how we understand biology, what we understand by the notion of being biological, what we understand by biological relatives, biological reproduction, etc. And the argument is that in vitro fertilization, far from being simply an imitation of a biological process, is actually the introduction of a new relationship to technology that displaces the former naturalness of the biological and gives us instead a kind of hybrid of biology and technology. And this argument, of course, has been made by many people. I'm not the first person to make this argument. It's been made by Marilyn Strathern. It's been made by Bruno Latour. It's been made by Paul Robineau, Don Haraway. Many people have pointed to the implosion, displacement, whatever you want to call it, of the natural. But what I think is helpful about in vitro fertilization as a case study is that we can walk through that process in the context of this one particular technique. And we can really see how the very process of pursuing biological offspring, biological relatives, biological kin, as it were, has allowed us to see very explicitly a different role for technology in what it means to reproduce, what it means to create kinship, and so forth. And it does so by introducing a new model of conception, the model of conception in glass, the model of conception that is literally manipulated using tools. And so what we get is a point where we can't really tell, in the context of an embryo in a petri dish, where the biology begins and the technology ends, or the other way around. We really can't separate out what's biological about that situation an embryo in a petri dish, and what's technological about it. And so I want to suggest that because IVF is now 30 years old, because there have been 5 million children born from IVF, because IVF has become a symbol in some ways of a different relationship to technology, that we need to think very carefully about what kind of analogy it's presenting to us about origins, about relationships, and about technology as well. So that's really the question I'm asking, as you said earlier, the question about what kind of mirror does IVF provide to look at ourselves? What kind of lens does it offer through which we might understand the biological differently? And how can we examine that from the point of view of both social science and science studies?
Great. Now, terms like mirror and lens, these are just two of many, many terms that recur in the book that constellate around the importance of instruments and tools, instrumentality, and these ideas as they frame the way that, at least from the perspective of one reader, right? That's the perspective that I'll offer, but the way that these issues help us rethink not just the co-creation of new forms of biology and technology, but also the ways that these are imbricated in notions of instruments and tools and work with hands specifically. So as we move into the first chapter, you really set the stage for us to have a really deep understanding of these issues by introducing the larger context of these issues as they come up in the Industrial Revolution, and then are worked out in the work of Marx and Engels specifically. And so you talk here in this first chapter about the importance to the study of the work of Marx and Engels, and specifically their ideas about the relationships between tools and hands. And hands are going to be recurring throughout the book as a really important touchstone for what's happening with IVF. So can you talk a little bit here about this notion of the tools and hands early on, and how this motivates the kind of work that you're doing at this point early in the book?
Well, I'm among the many people who think that we still have a lot to learn from Marx and Engels. And, you know, now that we can read all their work online, and we can read different implications into his later work, Marx's later work in Capital. I think I've always thought really that in some ways the question to ask right now about the biological sciences is less about biocapitalism as about biocapital. Because, you know, IVF is right now on the verge of becoming more substantially financialized, which will really mean the emergence of a kind of biocapital market, biocapitalist market that we haven't seen before. But in lots of my previous work on other reproductive technologies and on Dolly the Sheep, I'm very, very interested in this idea of how the biological is made. And I'm very interested in that for two reasons. First of all, I'm interested in talking to the people who are actually doing the making, which I think is a very important thing to do, and also observing very, very closely what they think they're doing with their tools. And one of the most interesting things that people are doing in stem cell labs right now is they're making tools out of biological elements. Hannah Landecker has written about this very eloquently, and I rely a lot on her work. And the way that people are making tools out of other tools is not unusual. That's a very key feature of the history of technology. But the way people are now making tools out of things like human embryos gives us a slightly different take on what a tool is. When a human embryo becomes an important tool through which we try to understand the mechanisms of human tissue repair, for example, we have a form of tool use that we could describe as recursive. It's coming back to redefine how we understand what a tool is. It's coming back to present technology as a kind of identity. And that question, in turn, the question of technology as identity, reciprocates very powerfully with the work of Foucault, the work of Judith Butler, and the work of the many theorists who have asked what it means to talk about technologies of self, technologies of sex, technologies of gender, technologies of identity, identity as a technology. And I think, again, if you look at in vitro fertilization, it's a very, very useful example through which to explore that link, the link between what we might describe as the meaning of a tool and our technologies of self. And this was Marx's key point. You know, he said, you can't just understand the history of tool or machine evolution in terms of a progressive accumulation of improvements. You have to understand them as products of history. You have to understand them as social products. You have to understand them as products of how people thought about themselves, not just how they thought about their tools or their work or their labor. You know, he was a great observer of mechanics and apparatus, and actually not such a great observer of gender, but we can forgive him for that. And he was very interested in mills and milling, and why, for example, over millennia, mills and milling don't change. And then we get to the early Industrial Revolution and the early, you know, water wheel driven mills in the Industrial Revolution in the north of England. And all of a sudden, we start to have this very, very, very rapid change, really, really rapid change in the scale of power applied to milling and other machinery. And he said, you know, you can't just understand this as somebody figured out a better way to run a, you know, water wheel. You have to understand why the desire to run a water wheel so much more efficiently came about. And that was a social process, not a technological one. So we have to understand IVF, you know, not just in terms of the desire to have children per se, which isn't a simple desire to begin with, even though it's often thought of that way. And we have to understand, why did the desire to have children in this way come about? Because that's a social question, not just a technological one.
Right. And I will say, forgive me if I start getting even less articulate than I started with, because this part of the book gets me really excited. You've completely convinced me from this part of the book that I need to go back and look again at Marx and Engels, because this is an aspect of that work that, at least for me, reading of this in graduate school, just completely glossed over. And so bringing this into the back into the discussion of tools and instruments and these aspects of the work was really exciting. And it was particularly exciting because you're talking in the book, at least for me, really exciting. My partner on the ride to work today had to listen to me talking about this for like 45 minutes. So I'm being completely genuine here. But it's exciting in part because the kinds of tools that come up in this part of the book are tools that include embryos and other sorts of biological, technological material, but also you have accounts of postdocs making their own pipettes, you know, and talking about the intricacies of the kind of tip to put on the pipette, how to mold it. And so there's this really beautifully textured artisanal culture that also comes out of this account. And so that's what maybe we can move to now. So part of the, again, this comes out throughout the book, but one of the great things about every chapter of the book is that you are weaving together here not just a really careful consideration of these concepts as they come up in the work of other historians, other anthropologists, other theorists, but also grounding it in really interesting ethnographic fieldwork. And so that fieldwork that you bring up in these early chapters of the book is fieldwork that you did at Guy's Hospital. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so Guy's Hospital in London. And you talk about a particular feature of this specific space, which is the hole in the wall and the division of labor that happens through this hole in the wall. So for listeners, can you introduce this for us? What's going on at Guy's Hospital in London? What is this hole in the wall, and how is this central to the work you're doing in this early part of the book?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened with in vitro fertilization, of course, is that the ability to observe, to manipulate, and to experiment with human embryos has led to a great deal more understanding of biological development and how it can be, as it were, taken in hand. And over the course of the same period that IVF became much more popular, much more widespread, much more normal, there have been a corresponding set of changes in how human and other mammalian embryos are understood. And some of the most dramatic of these changes happened at the end of the 20th century when, for example, it became clear that it was possible to reverse developmental time and that you could, as it were, reprogram a cell to go back to a quasi-embryonic state, and that this harnessing of cellular potential could lead to all sorts of new applications for human health and other kinds of basic science. So, you know, the relationship between in vitro fertilization and basic developmental biology became, as it were, much more intimate. And reflecting this was the effort to build stem cell labs that would be adjacent to IVF clinics, so that an egg that was going to be used for IVF could go straight into a very, very high quality research facility, and it could then either come back out of that facility to be used clinically for embryo transfer, or if there were some eggs or embryos that weren't going to be used for treatment, which there usually are, because there's usually more eggs and embryos if you get to that stage of IVF, they could either be frozen or they could be donated to research. So the hole in the wall is the literal hatch through which eggs and embryos go back and forth between IVF and stem cell derivation. And I've referred to this as the IVF stem cell interface, and that intimacy between those two spheres, between the basic science and the clinical applications, is again part of the way that IVF has become a kind of platform, or as I call it, a stem technology for the development of other tools, because a cultivated human embryonic stem cell line is now itself a kind of diagnostic apparatus, a kind of model system, a kind of instrumental part of the laboratory experience and the laboratory investigation. And, you know, people in science studies will be particularly fluent in the literature that addresses these sorts of changes. But to see them happening, you know, at the level of architecture that's been built to facilitate the looping of embryos from assisted conception into stem cell derivation back again is a very, very interesting kind of moment in the history of technology, a very interesting place to stop and consider what kinds of technological change are occurring here and how do we understand them? How do we create appropriate languages to describe what's going on? I'm a big fan of actually going and looking when you want to understand something and talking to people. And I'm very, very grateful to the team at GUIDES who I've worked with since the late 1990s for having introduced me to so many techniques and explanations, and they've been enormously generous with their time, which I've really, really appreciated, because I think it's a very, very important way to learn, to actually go and see for yourself. I mean, it's not very easy. Obviously, you have to be reasonably determined to make that happen. But if you are determined, and if it is what you're doing as your research, then the people who you're working with are usually very appreciative of that, because you're taking the time to go find out what they're doing and find out why they're doing that instead of something else.
And one of the, I'll just mention for listeners, just again, to put another point on it, actually no pun intended, before we move on to what's going on in the chapters, but the importance of handicraft production and hand-based work is really, really striking here. And it's one of the many, many ways that hands are really at the center of what's happening throughout this book in a way that really surprised me and was also really fascinating. So as we move into the later chapters, chapter 3 in particular, other forms of discourse come up that have also been central to understanding IVF and the kind of work that IVF does. And chapter 3 looks specifically at the language of the frontier and the language of pioneering on the frontier. So the trope of the pioneer has been really central to understanding the work of IVF, and this comes up in the context, as I've mentioned, of the discussion of IVF in terms of a reproductive frontier. And so this chapter traces this frontier idiom, especially insofar as it informs a way to think about biology and technology and their co-creation in this context. So can you talk about that for a bit? How and why has the trope or the frontier been such a compelling way to understand and to talk about IVF?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, there's a number of themes that sort of run through the book. And one of them is this notion of craft and making and what it means to be crafting and making tools, you know, out of human cells, and also what it means to be crafting and making identities, and whether IVF is really as much a way of crafting an identity as it is of crafting a cell. And this idiom of the frontier is another one of the themes, in part for the simple reason that IVF and stem cell research are frequently described as frontier technologies. And so I want to talk a little bit about the origin of that idiom for science. Where does it come from, that idea of the frontier? And I write a little bit about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and his introduction of the idea of the frontier and his idea of a transfer of the sciences of war into the pursuit of improved human health, and how he drew on the specifically New World model of the American frontier. And that's an idea very much of the frontier line advancing, as it were, forward, quite different from the European idea of the frontier, which is a border between two states. And I wanted to contrast that sort of narrative model of the frontier as a space of scientific advance with what people are actually doing in a lab, and specifically what they're often doing with their cells, with their equipment, with their space, which is really much less like marching forward into an unknown frontier, and is really much more like almost groping and feeling and touching and trying to see, you know, what's around you. And in the space between these two models of the frontier, this gap, as it were, between the frontier as a place that becomes a place of settlement, a place that becomes a place that's behind you, and the reality of the frontier going forward, which is much more like being in a dark room and not really being able to see anything, I wanted to ask a question about what this idiom of the frontier is doing exactly. What is it describing exactly? It's what we might call a very ambivalent analogy. And ambivalence is another of the themes in the book, because the ambivalent relationship we have to technology in general is very linked to the ambivalent space of the frontier, I suggest. And so again, you know, this is a theme, you know, a very old theme in the study of technology, that we can see in a slightly different light when we look at in vitro fertilization, when we take that as a case study. And this question of, you know, where is it headed and, you know, what does it mean and how would we know? We have to ask the people who are, as it were, on the frontier, the people who are undergoing these treatments, the people who are working with stem cell lines, you know, you have to ask them, where do they think we're going? What is this all about? And we get some very interesting answers, and we get very ambivalent answers. We don't get simple, confident answers, you know. I mean, okay, there's a kind of newspaper version of what stem cells are about, but if you talk to serious people who are doing serious work in labs, there's a number of different equivocal feelings people have about what they're doing, and that's the place we need to go if we want to have a more intelligent conversation about technology. I think that's the place we have to go if we want to have a more open, a more sophisticated, a more nuanced, a more attentive discussion about technology, rather than just throwing around all these cliches.
And this, I was going to ask you about this a little bit later on, but since it's just come up, this trope of, not just trope, but ambivalence as a tool to understand what's happening here is really, really important for the book. And you're talking about this also later on in the book in the context of a kind of genealogy of work that gets us to understanding the kinds of terms in which you're putting IVF in this study. Why do you think ambivalence is so generative in this context? Because you're using it in a very specific way. And it's not just, I mean, the way that, at least, again, from my perspective, it emerges in the book is not just as a, oh yeah, it's also, you know, it's ambivalent, you know, like lots of things are. Ambivalence is really kind of key to understanding why IVF becomes shaped the way it is in the way you're presenting it here. So what is so important and generative about this ambivalence here in the context?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's lots of ways it's important in it too, like hope, like some other, like curiosity, really, like some other emotions or feelings is an under-theorized area. I wanted, on the one hand, to point to the way that kinship has been described as a very deeply ambivalent set of relations. And this is implicit in a lot of the anthropological literature on kinship and kin ties and kin formation, but it's an argument that's made very explicitly by the anthropologist Michael Pellitz, who argues, a bit like Raymond Williams says about technology, he argues that ambivalence is a very poorly understood aspect of kinship relations, and yet one of the most ubiquitous and self-evident aspects of kinship relations. So I wanted to use that to open up the question of having children, having biological children, creating biological relatives. I wanted to trouble slightly the self-evident quality of the desire to have children. I wanted to point to the way that IVF doesn't respond to a simple desire to have children. It responds to many, many other things in addition to that. It responds to the need people feel who want children but don't have them to do a kind of life repair or identity repair, to get out of a situation where they feel they're stuck, they aren't moving in the direction they want to be moving in, et cetera, et cetera. And often, and somewhat paradoxically, IVF can appear as a way to do something, to attempt to resolve the difficulties felt when there's unwanted childlessness. And I wanted to look at the way that IVF can respond to a desire for children at so many different levels, and to ask whether that's one of the reasons that IVF is so popular, despite the fact that it mostly fails. Because one of the most interesting things about in vitro fertilization is why it has become so popular and so widespread, given the fact that it still fails for most people most of the time. There have to be things about IVF that appeal in addition to its potential to enable the birth of biological offspring if people want it so much, despite the fact that it usually doesn't do that. So So I wanted to use ambivalence as a way in to that question. And then I also just wanted to use it as a way to think about technology. It's, of course, quite a well-established way to think about technology. But IVF is kind of a new context in which to raise that question about technological ambivalence and to link it in some ways to the ambivalence of certain core aspects of identity, including reproductive identity, gender identity, kinship identity, and so forth.
Great. And actually, a couple of the chapters actually go into different aspects of this question of what is IVF producing above and beyond offspring, right? Because if the success rate is relatively low, why do people do it? And you talk here in various points of the book about the quest itself, right, being a product of this, like a kind of public performance of the IVF quest as being just as much a product that comes out of this, the sort of gender heroic performance that comes out of the quest. And so again, just like the terminology and the rubric and the concepts of the frontier and the pioneer, we have here in a really important way the notions of a quest and of a performance and a public performance of identity that become really integral to understanding the kind of work that IVF is doing as a technology producing identity. So that's another really interesting aspect of this part of the book. So you talk at various points also in this part of the book, especially the second half, of the idea of kinship as a technology. So earlier in the book, you're exploring new forms of kinship that are produced by IVF and that are producing IVF in turn, and are looking at, or are, as I read this, urging us to think about reproduction and kinship not as already given, but as sort of need, as things that need to be produced through social relations and other forms of relationality. Now, in thinking about kinship as a technology and in thinking in this way, the book is not just changing the way we think of biology and the way we think of kinship and reproduction and sex. It's also changing in an important way how we think about and how we define technology. So can you talk a little bit about that? How does this sort of inform the way we ought to, can, should, might conceive of technology itself in a way that's different than we might have before we came to this book, and certainly the middle part of this book in particular?
Yeah, well, if you want to ask the question, you know, how did the human embryo become a tool? And you want to ask that question from the point of view of, and what does that have to do with gender as a technology? It's quite instructive to go back to the very same period during which IVF has become so naturalized and normalized and look at the theories of gender and kinship as technologies that have been developed during that period. And so one of the things I wanted the book to do is to provide almost a kind of meta review of the ethnography of IVF, but in the context of the history of theorizing gender as a technology. And when we use the expression technologies of gender, an expression that was introduced by Teresa DeLauridis and by Judith Butler in the 1980s, we want to really be thinking about what they meant about where gender comes from. And their point was that we can't assume that gender is just there as a consequence of sex. We have to really, in a way, assume the other way around, that our ideas of sex polarity, of sex difference, and so forth are deeply gendered, and they belong to a system that produces sex in a particular way. If we want to think of sex, gender, kinship, and so forth almost as a kind of grammar, kind of structural grammar, then it gives us a very interesting set of resources with which to think about what IVF is appealing to exactly. You know, it's a very ambitious question. In some ways, I really felt like it was a kind of impossible question, but it was sort of also an irresistible question. which is the trouble that we get into, us academics, you know. If you think about it too much, the next thing you know, you're going to have to write another chapter. So I ended up writing a very important chapter, chapter 4, about the history of the idea of gender as a technology and what that perspective on technology might help us to understand about reproductive technology, technologies of reproduction.
Now, chapter 5 also, strictly in the interest of time, I won't ask you to talk too much about it, but I just want to mention for listeners, this is another really great way into feminist debates over new reproductive technology, specifically in the 1980s. We've already talked a little bit about the notion of ambivalence being key to what's going on here, and this is something that comes up as a focal point of this chapter. But you're also showing us in this chapter the way the history and texture of these debates sort of moves to a turn to understanding the kind of experience or voice of women undergoing IVF as an important part of this conversation. And you talk about your own kind of autobiographical elements of this story and your own experience working with a particular group that's part of this story. And this brings us into, in a nice way, I think, the last chapters of the book, because this turn toward looking at experience of people undergoing these technologies, undergoing these sorts of transformations from the perspective of patients of IVF, is also very much part of a larger theme, perhaps, of the last part of the book that asks us to think about IVF in terms of a lived experience. Right, it's not just the people in the laboratories or in the clinics who are doing the research who are an important part of this story. It's also part of a larger way of life that incorporates lots of different people engaging in lots and lots of different ways with these technologies, with these forms of being. And so, one of the important themes through which we see this in the second part of the book, or rather in the later chapters of the book, is the theme of visuality. Images and visuality and visualizing this becomes really, really important. In the second half of chapter 6, you're looking at, among other things, at the visual cultures of IVF. At IVF as a kind of iconic technology in visual terms. And it offers a visual analysis of sort of screen-based handheld iconography of IVF. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's a really striking part of the book. The emergence of IVF as a visual trope and the kind of work that that does for the larger argument that you're making here.
Yeah, well, I want to use the visual culture of IVF in sort of two different ways in those chapters in the second part of the book. I want to argue in the chapter that you mentioned about the history of feminist debate about this area that it was really a very substantial debate. I mean, throughout the 1980s, there were hundreds and hundreds of books and articles written by feminists about reproductive technology. And I want to link the idea of ambivalence also to the idea of dialogue and to the idea of a conversation and to the question of what kind of conversation, what kind of consultation, what kind of public debate do we want to be having about reproduction going forward. And I think I want to use the visual culture of IVF because it has become so widespread. You know, it's become something people recognize. And when they see an image of microinjection on the evening news, when they see this enlarged picture of an egg cell, you know, that's being held by a large holding pipette on one side and is being pierced by an injection pipette on the other. And when we see these kind of live action images of microinjection, of ICSI, of somatic cell nuclear transfer, all the different ways in which we get the image from the micromanipulation machine, we're getting a very explicit representation of change in how reproduction occurs. It couldn't be a more explicit image of the relationship of biology and technology. It couldn't be a more explicit image of the handheld nature of that coupling, as it were. And so I wanted to engage with that imagery and use it to ask some questions about how IVF has become a much more widespread symbol, not just a much more widespread practice, but a much more widespread image that represents what we might call the age of biological control or the age of reproductive control. But against that kind of what you might call dominant, you know, even hegemonic image of biology being taken in hand, you know, biology being technologically manipulated with all of the ambivalence that may accompany that image. I also wanted to look at a different set of images by this artist, Gina Glover, who did the cover of the book, really beautiful image of chromosomes on the cover of the book. And she did all this artwork in an IVF clinic. So I wanted to sort of contrast what we might call a sort of mainstream popular image of biotechnical manipulation of reproductive cells with the equally powerful but more alternative imagery of an artist who was trying to represent the lived experience, the lived ambivalence often of going through an IVF program. And I wanted to bring that in the second part of the book to revisit the exact same questions I was asking in the first part of the book, but just to do it through looking, you know, through looking at these images and to ask, you know, how do we understand what we see? How do we understand the spectacle? What's the point of view? What are we being shown? How do we interpret how we're being shown? I think they're sort of useful questions to stimulate a dialogue, a more thoughtful dialogue in some ways than I think we've had about something like IVF.
Great. And I'm so glad that you brought up the work of Gina Glover, because I was going to definitely ask you about that next. So this is something that takes up and we can hear the dulcet tones of, or dulcet tunes of construction work off in the horizon over here. So let's just integrate that into the way we're thinking.
An appropriate, exactly. An appropriate technological background.
Exactly. Yeah. Technology comes into our conversation here. I'll just, there we go. So chapter 7 really explores the work of this fascinating artist in detail and integrates this into the other elements of the conversation that you're giving us in the other chapters of the book. So as you've mentioned, the work of Gina Glover is featured on the cover of the book, and you describe her work as artist in residence at an IVF center. And one of the really important things about this that you, at least again, from my perspective that you're bringing out in discussing her work, is it's not just kind of a superficial, now let's look at art, right? This is her work is part of an exhibit, The Art of ART, that the clinic has decided to make part of their space, and is really, as you describe it, part of how the clinic understands its work is through the production of this kind of visual imagery. So it's an important part of the work of the clinic that we're understanding through the work of this artist. Now, the cover image of the book is from one of the pieces that you talk about in this chapter, and this is a piece called Chromosome Socks. So they're chromosomes, but also chromosomes that are rendered in a very particular way that evokes this larger theme of tools and instruments and their engagement with bodies that we see coming up throughout the book, because the chromosomes that are being positioned on the cover are actually stripy socks. And they're stripy socks that were donated, or some of them were at least donated by geneticists she was working with. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So can you describe this piece for us, at least part of it, in the way that speaks to the larger arguments that you're making in the book? Because I think this is a really great set piece to help listeners understand the ways that visual arts and the production of visual art by this particular artist specifically really opens up some of the conversations that you're having about IVF in the book.
Well, this is, as you say, a book that's very concerned with craft and technique and how we understand technology. And so, of course, it's a book that has to ask and explore its own craft and technique and technology. And as academics, as writers, as thinkers, as scholars, of course, we are also craft workers in many ways. We are very much a part of a received kinship in some ways of technique. Citational practice is something that I think is probably at the heart of the academic scholarly tradition, and I definitely want my citational practice in this book to be doing a particular kind of craft work. And when I met Gina Glover, what was really, really interesting was that I recognized so much of what I value about my own craft in her work, because she was sort of like an ethnographer doing her residence in hospitals, and she was trying to learn how she could use artistic imagery, photography in her case, as a kind of interface between the people working in the lab, the people working in the clinic, the people coming to the clinics, and the wider world, as it were. And she talked about how, you know, she failed initially to make images that really worked for the people she was working with, and how she ultimately was able to devise a visual language that relied in part on imitation. And so her image, Chromosome Socks, is an imitation of a karyotype, but it's a very wry and clever imitation of a karyotype, because it's clearly an artist's representation of a karyotype, and indeed an artist's commentary on a karyotype. And so what it does is it sort of plays with the karyotype image by using socks instead of chromosomes, by positioning them so they look just like they would on the grid of a karyotype that's made by a geneticist, but they kind of tweak that image as well, and they add into it other elements that are implied by a karyotype. For example, it's a karyotype of a person who's related to other people. It's a karyotype of a person who's being diagnosed for something. And so, for example, this domestic idiom of the socks, the familial idiom of the socks that were gifted to her by the geneticists, adds another layer of understanding to how we view something that's often received as quite a technical part of a medical diagnosis. And she used the same technique in the art of ART. She would draw on her relationships with people in the clinic to gather materials that she could then use to speak back to the experience she was attempting to represent. And so she uses a number of different visual, you could call them puns, I think, but maybe that's not quite getting the richness of her imagery. They're playing on the meanings of things in a way that open up other ways of thinking about them, as artists often do. And so towards the end of the book, I go through a number of the images that she produced for this clinic as a way, again, of revisiting the question of craft, revisiting the question of dialogue, revisiting the question of representation, and also revisiting the question of the frontier, because she's made this art, as you mentioned, in the waiting room, in actually all the rooms of the IVF clinic, and for that matter, in parts of the laboratory. So it is, in a way, frontier art. It is art that surrounds this intersection between basic science and clinical medicine in the context of reproduction.
Fabulous. And from the perspective of somebody who picks up the book as well, seeing this chromosome socks piece on the cover, it gives, before you even open the book, it gives the reader immediately the experience of this making strange that you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation. Because at least for me and in my household, people who have seen the cover of this book, you look at it quickly and you think, oh, there are chromosomes on the cover, it's karyotype. And then you look again and you think, oh my goodness, they're socks. What's going on there? And so it's this wonderful, sort of also pleasurable experience of curiosity of what's going on here, of strangeness, that I think really sets the visual or visually sets a tone that's going to recur throughout the book. So it's a brilliant choice for the cover of the book. I think it works really well. And I highly urge listeners to definitely pay special attention to chapter 7, because the work of Gina Glover is just such an interesting, so interesting, as you mentioned, put in dialogue with the work that you're doing elsewhere in the book and your own work as part of this project. So there's also a chapter, I won't ask you too much about this, again, purely in the interest of time, but chapter 8 functions as a kind of conclusion for the book. This chapter rereads and sort of recovers some of the arguments that we've seen in previous chapters by engaging ideas first from Plato and then working from Plato into Derrida. So it really uses some of the ideas and work of Derrida to rethink some of the points that you're making in the book. You're also talking in this chapter, again, about the importance of dialogue as a kind of contact zone, right? And so contact zone also comes up repeatedly in the book as a term that we are using to think through these ideas with. And also you consider in this chapter of the book how ideas, specifically how some ideas of kinship have been revised to take into account new forms of relationship, of relationality, of relativity that have been produced by IVF technology and by the use of mitochondrial DNA technology in particular. So, Sarah, there's a ton of material in the book that we don't have a chance to talk about in detail. It's extraordinarily rich, and I think even if we had 2 more hours, we would still not exhaust what's in here. It's a really, really wonderful and wonderfully rich study. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners, and especially perhaps for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to read the book?
Well, I suppose the one thing I would want to say in closing is that, you know, it is a feminist book, and it is, among other things, an attempt to really look back at the history of feminist scholarship on technology, and in particular on IVF, and to suggest that that is possibly an underutilized scholarly tradition that we might want to think about a little bit more carefully going forward, because in some ways the history of IVF is now one of the most carefully documented case studies of this increasingly intimate relationship between biology and technology. And in some ways, some of the key terms we associate with the study of what Ian Wilmot calls the age of biological control are drawn from Foucault or from other theorists who've looked at biology. And, you know, biology was an absolutely central concern to so much feminist work right from the very beginning. You know, from very, very early on, the questions of biology and technology were absolutely central to feminism. And one of the things I really want the book to do is to remind us of the richness of that legacy and to try and engage it more fully and use it as a resource going forward.
So speaking of resources going forward, now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, as I'm sure is abundantly clear, I think it's fabulous and I really, really enjoyed it and also learned a lot from it. What's next for you? Are there any projects that are currently inspiring you?
Well, I've been very fortunate to receive quite a bit of research funding over the past couple of years. So I now have a big 5-year project set up at Cambridge and a terrific team looking at histories and cultures of IVF. So really extending this set of questions that were laid out in the book and trying to investigate them in more detail. And our team is called ReproSoc. So you can go to the website and see the research group on reproductive sociology at Cambridge, where we've got lots and lots of really exciting things happening. So we're blogging and we're tweeting and we're organizing events and publishing things. So we're basically taking this whole project forward on a larger scale. So I'm very excited about that.
Great. Repro Soc.
Yeah, Repro Soc.
Socks again. Back to
I know.
Socks.
It's true. Yeah, I know. We have Gina Glover's on our webpage too. Yeah, I know. It's true. Well, you, where would we be if we couldn't have a few, puns included?
Exactly. So on that note, thank you so much, Sarah. It's really been a pleasure. Congratulations and best of luck with Repro Soc as you move forward.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll see you next time.